Welcome to the podcast that is found
This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Hey, this is Chris and I smell like a yak.
That is true. But that's beside the point. At this point, this episode we're discussing Stargate, starring Kurt Russell, James Spader, Jay Davidson, Vivica Lindfors, Alexis Cruz, Millie Avital, and directed by Roland Emmerich. So, I have a strange feeling that all of us have different stories as to how we came to this particular movie. And I think that the one who probably has the most interesting story is probably Kent. So, Kent, how did you find Stargate?
Well, you see, I was digging in Egypt. You see, this is a multi-layer, over-decades story here. So, yeah, which is scary. It's like, wait, this came out in 94. How is this decades? Yeah, welcome to 20 years later. Originally, when this movie came out, and I was trying to find my actual quote for this, I was in college. I did not see this in the theaters, but I had a professor at the time who was, she was a linguistics professor, and she was kind of cracking on the whole media behind this because they were going out talking about, media spiel for this, Emmerich and Devlin were going out talking about how they know the secret language of how to speak hieroglyphics. And she was just slamming on it going, no, there's no way you know how to pronounce hieroglyphics because the language itself is dead. We know what it says because we could translate the words. We don't know what it sounds like. And then eventually, you know, kind of have a joke about it. And I can't remember if I saw it like a couple years later. I think probably like maybe 96 or 97 I actually got to see it and actually had started an opinion about it. But never really came back to it. And then like years later when the TV series was in full swing, which I'm sure we'll have to touch on eventually in this, friends of mine would not, there were times friends of mine would not shut up about it and just would go on and on and on and on and on and on about what's going on in the show. So I went back and one year that, you know, things were not going well, went and rewatched the movie as a basis, as a point of origin to start watching everything. So, that's like a 20-year story going. So, yeah.
What about you, Chris? How were you made aware of Stargate?
My story is a lot less interesting because I was... I think I was 10 when the movie came out. So, and I think I saw it on video, like VHS at some point, and it basically remained buried there in the back of my mind until this podcast, you know, how many years later. I don't feel like doing math, so
So for me, Stargate, it was when I saw the first trailer for it, I was on one of those movie trailer TV shows, the ones that would just show nonstop movie trailers for like half an hour. And I saw this, and it looked like it was a mix of Star Wars and Indiana Jones. And so I was very interested in seeing this movie when it came out, especially since I just turned 18. Turned 13, and this is a PG-13 movie. So I was super excited about finally getting, or about seeing this movie, and it was finally coming out, and lo and behold, before I got a chance, it left theaters fast. Cut to home video, which was, what, maybe 6 to 8 months after the fact? And by this particular point, because you know they had the video game tie-ins, I played the video game, like, non-stop for about a few months. And so I was really excited about finally getting to watch the movie. And the movie actually ruined the video game for me because I love this movie. But it was one of those, it was definitely one of those movies that I watched the hell out of for, like, 4 years straight. You know, pretty much up until I was about 17 years old. And when I had heard about the TV show, I was really disappointed that Roland Emmerich wasn't going to get involved in it, or Dean Devlin, and that they were going to kind of take it in a different direction. And I was, I actually protested the TV show up until about 2003. So yeah, it's one of those types of things. I was a hardcore fan for this movie. Even when it came to like Independence Day, which I absolutely loved, Stargate was still my jam. And so there's a soft spot in my heart, but it's also one of those first movies that when I was starting to become a film critic in my own right, I had to reevaluate, and it was one of those movies that I kind of got really harsh on in my 20s because it was, you know, it wasn't quote-unquote a great film. And, or, you know, a great film in the sense of it being like a critically applauded film. And so it kind of switched back and forth between I like the movie, but it's bad, and became, I kind of like to call it a guilty pleasure, but it's time to settle it once and for all. So for this particular podcast, I decided that I'm going to look at the good and the bad and the ugly of this movie and give it an honest assessment that kind of puts my fandom aside and look at it from a film perspective, if I were to tackle this like any other film that we would for this podcast. So I guess we should start off with the fact that this is, in fact, a Roland Emmerich film.
Yes.
Now, we had talked about Mr. Emmerich before, about a year and a half ago, when we were talking about Independence Day. Now, Chris, what is your opinion on Roland Emmerich as a director for that particular film as well as his other films?
I mean, I feel like I liked him more when I was younger because, like, I haven't really kept up with them in recent years because, like, I just kind of stopped caring.
What? You kind of told me that you didn't watch 2012 or Anonymous or...
I think I watched 2012 and was like, eh, it was a movie. I don't know. I just kind of lost interest. It was just kind of meh. And I haven't really watched Independence Day as an adult, so I don't really, all I have is what I felt like as a kid, and I remember really liking it. Having one of those stupid models that you had to put together of the alien that I never put together correctly because the glue was an asshole.
That's true. Yeah. Did Independence Day Resurgence kill your love for Roland Emmerich's work?
I never actually got out to see it.
Oh, I see.
It just didn't feel right. Yeah.
It's fucking awful. Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, I will say that Independence Day Resurgence isn't that bad. It's not a good movie. It's a bad movie, but it's not that bad. It's not like worst film of the year bad.
One of the things I heard was that Resurgence was Resurgence bombed, therefore Emmerich's Stargate remake or redo or revisit could not happen because they lost faith.
Honestly, but I see Roland Emmerich's film career kind of coming to a bit of a halt. And especially after the clusterfuck of Geostorm, I could probably say the same thing for Dean Devlin as well. But that's for a whole different podcast.
Cast, okay.
But, all right, so let's go ahead and let's talk about Stargate. Now, prior to Stargate, Roland Emmerich had directed a movie called Moon 44, and then he directed a movie called Universal Soldier. Have either of you seen those films?
I think I've seen Universal Soldier. It's one of those... Did we watch it, like, on a Saturday afternoon when, like, some of us were barely paying attention kind of things and we made fun of it, movies? I'm not That's what it reminds me of when I think about it, but I'm not 100% on that.
Chris?
I've seen Universal Soldier, but again, it was, like, as a kid, and I went through a phase where I saw a bunch of Van Damme films, and all I remember from Universal Soldier is Dolph Lundgren wearing that necklace of ears. And that's
that
my memory
a very
of Universal
memorable
Soldier
moment. But did you see Universal Soldier before or after Stargate?
I want to say before.
I think it would be before.
So, and I'm pretty sure that that this was before you were paying attention to directors, right? Or did you know that Roland Emmerich, when you saw Stargate, was the director of Universal Soldier?
No, I never would have crossed my mind at the time.
I didn't care at that point. Yeah. I wasn't paying attention. I was a kid. And I mean, like, oh, I'm going to see a fucking movie. Who cares?
You know, I mean, frankly, it surprises me that it's the same director as Godzilla. Yeah.
The crappy one?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, Ferris Zero's Day All Out. You know. That Godzilla. Surprised me. But then I think this is where Emmerich gets into my head as a disaster movie guy.
Right. Well, he's an epic guy. I think that's the thing. Like, people kind of associate him for his spectacles, and usually world-destroying spectacles. You know, he did Independence Day, he'd done Day After Tomorrow, he did 2012. He blows up the world better than anyone else, and that does include you, Michael Bay. And the thing is, though, is that it gets a little bit more silly every time that he does it, right? But the thing is, though, is that I don't see him as the movie that director that destroys the world as much as he's someone who loves spectacle. He loves making big, bombastic, over-the-top movies. And Stargate is definitely the beginning of that persona that he would develop. Because after this, he would do Independence Day and he would make all those other movies. But this has that grand epic feel. And understand, we've got, what, two locations in this film? I mean, we have the Earth location and we have the other planet. And the other planet is practically just sand with one town, and then we have the pyramid, right? There's not a whole lot in scenery in this film. And yet...
You basically have four locations. New York...
We have an interior work in the rainy sidewalk.
A military base, and then over on the planet you have Rao's ship and the village. Mm-hmm. Yeah, easy. I mean, you could technically say Egypt, but at the same time you could say, well, that was filmed at the same place as everything else, and yeah.
I mean, that could have all been done on the same back lot, to be honest.
Well,
I mean,
it was most of Egypt is actually CGI.
I know.
Yeah, I mean, that's the craziness of it.
Well, no, I mean, the thing is that when it comes to, like, the other planet, though, the one that they go to at the end of Stargate. Now, I know that the TV show gives it a name, but it doesn't get a name in the movie, right?
Right.
Or
right.
They give it, like, a designated number, but that's pretty much how they...
Yeah. They learn. And, I mean, it's basically later, it's like, we need a name. Okay, well, we found out the name because Daniel was there for a year.
Yeah. So. I'll call it LV-426 because, quite honestly, that's pretty much what that planet is. Oh, right?
Abydos.
All right, well...
If you want to use the SG-1 name.
So. I don't, but okay, we'll call it Abydos. You know, to appease the Stargate fans who are probably passing out that I associate.
LV-421? No, there's no aliens. Well, I mean, there are aliens.
But,
yeah.
But
what I meant to say was...
But at the same time, though, getting back to my point about what Roland Emmerich does is that he is creating an epic story. You know, he's telling this grand epic of warriors and battles and conflict with gods, and he sets up stakes and he sets up this kind of conflict between the various forces, and he gives it a lore and he gives it a backstory. I'll be honest, and the more that I think about it now, this does kind of play out as kind of like a pilot. If you really think about
sort
this,
of.
Well, I mean, let's be honest here. I mean, it sets up what the Stargate does. It sends us off to a planet that has a problem that's very episodic, right? They have to deal with that problem, and then they go back. And from that particular point, considering that the Stargate can go pretty much anywhere to other places,
well,
you know.
They don't establish that in the movie, that it could, even though it's kind of dumb that you have all these symbols and they have to have a combination.
But that's somewhere. What I'm saying, though.
Yeah, but... Devin and Emmerich intended this to be a trilogy, and they lost control and it became the TV series instead, which is probably for the best, but...
Well, the reason why they lost control was, first off, let's be honest here, Stargate bombed at the box office.
Yeah.
When I said that the movie disappeared, we're talking about, like, at week two. It made so little money, they threw it out of theaters quickly. And, yeah, this movie did not make the money that they were expecting. And they had all kinds of tie-ins. They were trying to sell this as an epic movie, as a tentpole movie.
There was a toy line. Come on.
There was toys. Remember, I was playing a video game of this. Now, they thought so highly that this movie was going to make so much. This was kind of the after Earth of the 90s. I know, that's saying something.
Yeah.
But, and we should also explain who one of the producers of this movie is, Mario Casar. Any of you know who Mario Casar is?
Sounds familiar. Scrolling.
Well, you're probably doing the whole IMDb or...
Yes, I am. I very much am. Oh.
Yeah. Well, okay. Let me go ahead and explain who Mario Casar is. Mario Casar is a producer, a Hungarian producer that kind of... I don't want to say that he's shady, but he has a tendency of screwing people over when it comes to making deals. And he will buy licenses that he intends to exploit to the highest potential. If they don't even come close to producing, though, he will tear it apart and sell it for scrap. One of the reasons why the Terminator movies after T2 have been such a cluster is because Mario Casar held onto the rights to Terminator until he absolutely had to sell it. And that was primarily because he wasn't doing anything with that. He also produced things like Total Recall and First Blood. He was huge into action and sci-fi. And, yeah, he held on to the Stargate Stargate license pretty much until the options ran out. And by that particular point, a little channel called Showtime was looking to create original television shows, kind of in the same realm as their competitor HBO, but they wanted to do it with genre titles, specifically science fiction. So they picked Poltergeist, they picked The Outer Limits, and they picked Stargate to start their initial run of original products and original content. And I think, I want to say Stargate was, about 3 or 4 seasons on Showtime before Sci-Fi Channel picked up.
Something like that.
Yeah. And of course it becomes what it is now. But going back to the movie, though, Casar did this with so many different franchises. It also included Universal Soldier as well. Again, one of the reasons why the sequels to Universal Soldier were so bad. But anyway, that said, Stargate, kind of the failure of Stargate really did have an impact on the viability of this being a potential franchise. And it would take television producers to see the potential that eventually came. But getting back to the film itself, though, let's talk about what this movie is trying to do. Now, we have two main protagonists here, right? We have a scientist and a soldier as our main protagonists. And this is a movie that sets up both characters very quickly and gives both, I think, about a scene each to set up their motivations, right?
Well, primary motivations and then expanding on it later, but yeah. We start out with Daniel, so.
Well, I mean, we have Daniel Jackson, who failed to make an impression with his scientific colleagues for pretty much something that he absolutely had no evidence on. We can all agree that Daniel Jackson comes off as a quack in the lecture, right? I mean, we're like, you know, we're about like 5 supplements short of Alex Jones here, right? Because he's making inferences. He's talking about how other noted scientists are wrong because he knows the key, but he never really explains why. Of course, they don't really give him a chance to explain.
Right. He's going for it, but then everybody abandons him. So it's almost like they know what he's going to say, so they're just humoring him so they can embarrass him.
You mean kind of like Alex Jones?
Yeah, well. Except he makes money.
Okay, that is true. That is very true. But we also, at the same time, are getting the story of Jack O'Neill, who is played by Kurt Russell in this film. And yet, the first time we see him, he doesn't actually say anything when we first meet him. He's kind of stuck in his own little personal hell, right?
Yeah.
Now, I should give a little bit of clarification here. The first time that I saw this film was about 2 months after, because I was just coming out of grade school. This was about 2 months after a friend of mine, who was about my age, had accidentally shot himself with a gun and killed himself. So having this in the movie kind of brought back some pretty awkward feelings for me specifically. But it's one that you can definitely understand the motivation for Jack, right? And this will definitely come into play later in the film, although looking at it from a film critic's perspective is a little forced. But do you feel that you kind of are understanding Jack a little bit starting off in the film?
We're understanding him. I'm just wondering if the guys picking him up, if they'd go, wait, he just had a death in the family? Is this the right idea to activate him right now?
Well, so there's two things. One, I don't think it happened just immediately, but when it comes to this, you get the tendency that he has probably been dealing with it for at least a few months. On top of that, that's also showing just how urgent the situation is. Now, Chris, out of curiosity, what was your impression of the way that we're introduced to Jackson and O'Neill?
It was kind of weird at first until the guy's like, "Oh, his son shot himself." I was like, "Oh, okay." So I didn't know what was going on at first. He's sitting in his son's room, just stroking a gun with Kurt Russell looking weird with blonde hair, and I'm like, "What the fuck?"
Yeah.
And then So.
I have to admit, it's especially the next time we see him and he has the Guile flat top.
Yeah.
Dude
looks fucking like Guile. What the fuck?
hey.
That was 90s military. Come on.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't 90s military.
Yeah.
That was straight up Street Fighter. I'm sorry.
It really was.
And I actually did listen to the audio commentary. Apparently, when Kurt Russell showed up on set for the first day, he didn't tell anyone that he was going to do the flat top. They weren't expecting it, but they decided just to go with it because, hey, if that's what he sees the character, that's fine. On top of that, it definitely helps with the beret. So you don't have to worry about that beret, you know, getting all lopsided or anything if it's flat. So there you go. But I will say, though, if you look at exactly what it is that they're about to do and what the urgency is, I can understand why they would pull in Jack O'Neill. Because this is a story that kind of depends on the pieces making sense. Because the question becomes, when we find out about the Stargate, what the Stargate can do, this is highly dangerous. Can we all agree that just the concept of a Stargate, a barrier that can allow you to move light years to distant planets and unfettered access from one portal to another, that needs to be a high priority issue? That needs to have all hands on deck, right? Especially if you have the ability to open it. Can we agree about that?
Well, one, you have to acknowledge that, oh my god, other planets are out there. Two, you better secure both ends of that thing.
I don't think there's any doubt about other planets out there.
It's when you get there and somebody else is already there is the issue. That socially back on Earth, that's going to cause people to go nuts. Like, well, how? What? And then when you have to analyze, okay, how did they get there? Oh, aliens. Oh, we better secure this, both ends of this portal. Well, and it's, yeah.
Well, there are several aspects that they've already announced that they understand that this had to come from alien life. And that's not including the scene that was cut from the director's cut. By the way, did either of you see the director's cut?
I believe what I was watching was the director's cut, because during the commentary they kept talking about, and here's a scene we had to cut from theatrical, but we put back in here. So.
All right, so the first scene that was in the director's cut, and this is one that I actually think really should have stayed in the theatrical, is the scene when they're pulling the Stargate from Egypt. Yeah. And, you know, they find the tablet, they find the Stargate, they pull both out, and underneath it is the bones of a weird type of creature.
The petrified warrior.
Petrified warrior. Because that sets up two things. One, we understand now why it was buried. Two, it also sets up the question, it also establishes that there is, in fact, alien life. That's not an issue at that particular point. The fact that this Stargate exists, the fact that they have proof of other life on other planets, so that removes that from the equation, and now we can focus on what is out there. And I think that the military needs to deal with it on that, and especially the way that they respond. The actions that the military takes in a response team, I guess you could even call it your initial SG-1 unit.
Yeah.
Well
Stargate units. SG-1 is Unit 1, basically. So.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
This is SG-0. They're the prototype.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, so.
And just to let you know, I'm on an XCOM binge, so I've got that in my head right now, too.
Ooh.
So, yeah. Lock and load, rock and roll.
Yeah.
But all the same, though, so the response, and I especially love how that scene between Catherine and Jack about why he's there. Why is it that the military is moving? And the thing is, especially because you know that there is a potential threat once you open that Stargate. And I love the fact that O'Neill even calls it out. I'm here in case you succeed. You know, because God knows what'll come through that gate. God knows what is possible once you are able to reach out to different planets and what threats there could be that you could find there. My only problem, and again, this is kind of just a sense of if we're taking this as a serious issue, is that they should also be concerned about biological issues.
Yes.
On those planets. And that's one thing that I'm going to ding Emmerich and Devlin on in their storytelling here. They want to kind of play it realistic, but they also really love their Indiana Jones. And
you're going to a different planet. There's probably going to be some new viruses and bacteria that are not a good thing.
Yeah.
Especially since Daniel's allergic to everything.
That's true. Honestly, I mean, they should be thankful that they hit a planet that's basically just desert, because you're not going to find a whole lot of spores on deserts.
Well, he could be allergic to the fur on the creatures, so
we'll be talking about that creature in just a little bit. We'll be talking, but all the same though, I guess in a way, this is where you kind of have to start to excuse the movie for being dumb. Can we all agree that this is not a very smart movie? Like, if you were to give this the Prometheus test, the Prometheus people probably take their science a lot more seriously than this movie does. Just a little.
You're thinking the team should have gone over in hazmat suits to begin with.
Well, let's put it this way. They packed all the luggage in the world to go onto this planet for the sole purpose of coming over there, looking all around, and then leaving. All right? They took, like, what, 12 of all types of guns? They took, you know, readouts, which is understandable if they're just leaving that stuff there. They took a lot of shit. We don't even know half the shit that they took. But we do know that a lot of weapons are taken, including a nuclear bomb. Which we find out that that O'Neill was basically going to blow up to begin with, which kind of makes the whole point of the entire mission pointless.
Well, only if he felt there was a threat. If there was no threat, might as well just go back.
But O'Neill would find anything a threat. I mean, if there were furry bunnies, I think that he'd blow the gate for that. Seriously, he was pretty much putting that thing together even before they found the harnessed yak. Right?
Yeah, just getting ahead of schedule.
Yeah.
So, this place is safe? Let's put it that way. Yeah. Yeah, and he wants to die. He's still semi-suicidal.
That's a big part of it. Yeah.
he could set it up and put it on a trigger, and then, yeah.
Well, they needed a suicidal guy because, quite honestly, it was going to be a suicide mission, right?
Which they didn't explain to the rest of the team. This could be a suicide mission. Oh, well.
But here's the thing that gets me about that, is the fact that the rest of his guys... They've worked with him before. There seems to be a camaraderie there, especially Kowalski.
Yeah.
It seems like Kowalski has definitely been working with O'Neill for a while. And so you would think that there's someone who would probably be able to kind of keep Jack in line. It would be Kowalski. And yet he really, they rarely talk. In fact, I will say one of the things that really annoys me about this movie is that the soldiers go from... zero to fuck you in like 5 seconds flat when Jackson says that he can't get the gate open. Or, you know, it's like they don't even wait for like 5 seconds until they start like ridiculing him. It's like, seriously, did y'all go to the Dubro boot camp? Is that the one that you went to? Because that just...
They had to give something for a French steward to do, though. So
yeah.
Well, they could have just not had French Stewart.
Oh,
true.
Oh,
I'm sorry. That would have been a
good thing to... say it again. Fuck it.
Oh, my God. This was not a French Stewart movie. Actually, I don't think there's any movie that I would ever call a French Stewart movie.
Inspector Gadget 2.
No.
Yeah.
He doesn't belong in movies. He belongs somewhere that nobody should ever have to see.
Oh, come on.
Well, I mean, he was okay in Third Rock from the Sun.
But he had other people to play off of that were, like, much better than he was.
Although, to be fair, a 10-year-old actually did out-act him. So, there is that.
True.
Well, we discussed that 10-year-old already a couple episodes ago.
True.
So
that's true. I will say, though, that it was this time around, I didn't actually realize that General West is Leon motherfucking Rippy.
Yeah.
Yeah, he looks so different.
It's the mustache. He actually says that during the commentary. It's like nobody knew who was showing up with the mustache. And it just
looks so different. I mean, and it's not just the mustache. The mustache kind of made him look like that actor in Terminator 2. But I mean, it's like the only reason I was able to realize it was Leon Rippey was his voice. It's like, that's the only thing that you can't hide with that. Yeah. With that. It's like, my God, I mean, he's... Yeah, and I guess I should say that I have a huge affinity for Leon Rippey, which apparently he has worked on the first three of Roland Emmerich's films. He was actually in Man 44, and he was also in Universal Soldier. So I guess he may be... lucky charm of a bit. So I guess I have a feeling we'll be talking about Leon Rippey in the Geek Sheet, so I don't want to get too caught up in that.
Actually, I don't think I brought him up.
Are you kidding me? You didn't bring up Leon
Rippey? Hold on a second. Oh, wait. Yes, I did. Never
okay.
mind.
All right. I was about to say.
He's like scribbling him in there now. No, there he is.
It was so long. I mean, what? I've got so much on here anyway, so.
I mean, don't get me wrong. Whatever you miss, I'm going to have because I have quite a few myself. But like, I noticed the likes of Richard Kind pretty quickly. Of course, how can you miss Richard Kind? The guy just Has he ever changed in like the last 30 years?
I don't think he's aged. I'm pretty sure he's an immortal.
Maybe so.
Yeah.
Maybe so.
So, I'm kind of surprised how many what could be considered comedic actors are in this. So, I mean, French Stewart is supposed to be a comedic actor, or that was his typecast before he was in this. And we just mentioned Richard Kind, who is just, you know, almost everything he's been in, but he's playing this fairly straightforward, so.
Honestly, I think that you could actually tie all of Richard Kind's parts into, like, a long narrative. Like, this is actually the same character who's bounced in and out of all these different movies and different shows.
That doesn't work for Inside Out.
Well,
that's like a formation in the young child's mind about anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. I'd have to explain the whole Inside Out thing as well as when he played a moth. But
yeah. Okay.
But that would require a little bit more brain cells than I intend to use today. But anyway, so let's go ahead and let's talk about when they actually jump through the Stargate, because this is where the movie really wants us to be, right? This is. Is this universe, considering that it's basically just a whole bunch of sand? I mean, let's be honest here.
The Arizona
Anakin
Desert.
Skywalker looks at this planet and he itches, right?
Yeah, he goes, God damn it, another sand planet.
just saying. But I will say, one of my all-time favorite movies is Lawrence of Arabia, and that movie knows how to shoot sand.
Yeah.
This movie doesn't know how to shoot sand. Seriously, you know, it's like, you know, when it comes to deserts, you have to get the vastness of the space. You have to be able to see kind of the distance and really kind of give it depth, because otherwise you're just looking at a sandbox, right? I mean, that's one of my biggest problems when it came to the Dune miniseries that Sci-Fi Channel tried to pull, was basically they just threw sand everywhere and that you're supposed to just believe that that's a planet. And with Stargate, it's not as bad as the Dune Sci-Fi Channel miniseries, but very, very rarely do you see actual dunes. And usually when you do, the movie puts it so close, and with so many close-ups, with very few wide shots, you know, with the exception of a couple that are for story purposes. And so you really don't get the vastness of this desert. In fact, you'd almost think that this temple and the city are pretty much like what?
Within a few miles of each other?
Basically, you know, just a hop, skip, and a jump. You know, you probably could see the temple from the pyramid from the city and vice versa, right? I mean, that's pretty much how it kind of feels. You don't get the vastness of the space. You don't get the grandness of the desert. You have no scope, and that's something that really kind of hinders my enjoyment of the film, because I want to believe that this is a planet, and I feel like it's just a very small area. Do y'all have that problem with this movie, or do y'all not even think about it?
Well, I figured they'd want that settlement near the gate, but not too close. But yeah, it does feel like you should be able to see the two from each other if you're even a mile or two, even if you were like 5 miles away, with nothing in the way, you should be able to see each other.
Yeah.
But unless there's like a mountain in the way, which they don't establish, and they just go, oh, there's sand. Well, that's not quite how sand works, so.
Well, we need to at least have an establishing shot showing the distance between the pyramid and the city, at the very least. Yeah, there could be a few dunes here and there, but we need to kind of get a point of it. And on top of that, the pyramid needs to be far enough away from the city so that the villagers don't constantly keep coming to it. Because the whole point of the pyramid is basically it's a dock. It's a docking station for this spaceship, right? That's pretty much what it is.
It's a landing pad.
You know, you get the sense that they really don't want the villagers to really think too much about their visitors. And I'm also assuming that the reason why they have those little skyhoppers is so that they could traverse that distance between the pyramid and the village in minutes instead of hours, and be able to move forces back and forth really quickly.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah. Well, and as a terror weapon, show up and go and let them know who's God here.
Yeah.
Because they don't have anything that flies. In fact, you don't even see any birds on that planet.
No. The only thing that we see are the yaks.
Yeah.
And I guess the reptiles that make up the food.
Right.
But
tastes like chicken.
But also, here, this is the kind of inquisitive mind that's in me about this. How do they capture the food? Because if you're not growing things, you have to kind of go where the food goes.
The kids who aren't mining are actually shepherds. It's so all domesticated. It's all domesticated.
They shepherd reptiles?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or have like pens or some sort of farm system for it.
Reptiles and pens. That that's new. That is new. That's iguana farms.
Yeah. You can have a full-fledged... Now, what gets me is where you're getting your plant material from. Unless there's, like, plants we don't see. Like, there's a cactus grove out behind the city that they deal with. But
well, the thing is that when you have the feast, they only offer the meat. So we don't get the sense... Oh, I guess they have bread. There's kind of a leavened bread kind of thing. But no, for the most part, though, if you're kind of having to hunt for food, especially if that's your primary source of a food source, you got to keep going where the food goes. You can't stay in one place.
Yeah, unless you've domesticated everything. And actually, since they say Rob brought all these slaves over to be a civilization, he had to have thought about the whole food chain getting set up if there wasn't already a food chain there.
Yeah.
Otherwise, all of his slaves die of starvation, and that's just not good for being a slave master. Slaves.
I mean,
yeah, but then he goes, whoops, these guys need to be a little more self-sufficient because I can't think of everything. So.
Well, I mean, you get the sense that they were pretty quick to kill off slaves up until the revolution. Right. And then when they lost their source of slaves on Earth through the Stargate, they cultivated the slaves that they had and just kept them going for, 2,000-3,000 years?
Longer than that, because I think when did pyramid building stop? Like 5,000 years ago?
Okay, here's something I'm thinking about. And maybe this is me thinking way too hard on Stargate.
Okay.
While you are able travel beyond the speed of light using this machine. By the way, how on earth did that little tracking thingy determine?
They never answered that in anything. And and they abandon it within like half a season of the TV series because it's just... That's kind of dumb.
It's stupid.
Yeah. Really, really stupid. I think they decided that.
The way I'm thinking is that even if you're traveling at the speed of light, and if we go by the premise of the start of what Stargate does after this movie, those civilizations probably had been working for less time than they than we were. So basically, they were working in slow motion. I'm basically kind of going off of what I learned in Interstellar. So I could be completely wrong and be pulling shit from my ass, but I don't know. Just something about this doesn't feel like there's been a lot of evolution occurring. Because even without the aspects that that allowed for human innovation over the over the course of basically about 300 years, 300-400 years, there would still be an evolution of thought. There'd be a renovation of being able to do work, mechanics, mechanical processes. That doesn't require higher education, just innovation. And I get the sense that Ra is not against them innovating as long as they subjugate themselves to his will. right?
I don't know. I get the feeling he's against any innovation. Because any innovation could lead to thinking. I mean, he doesn't allow writing. I mean, that's a big part of innovation.
I have a problem with that because, as we find out...
they've been cheating. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Shari knows how to write. So they obviously know, they just aren't showing it. They don't want to be seen. So I don't believe that. Or the movie has some serious holes that they really haven't thought about, which could definitely be the case. But where do you fall on this, Chris? You're a little quiet over there.
On which part of it?
On the innovation aspect of this civilization.
I'm not really sure.
Do you think that Ra is completely hobbling their ability to innovate? Or considering the fact that even though they're not supposed to write, they're still seeming to be able to write, that they might still be innovating, or they should have been more innovative than they are?
Again, I'm not sure. I think I watched the director's cut, and are there supposed to be subtitles?
There's some subtitles here and there. But there are other.
Yeah, I had none. Whatsoever for some reason. Yeah, I had no subtitles at all.
That's weird. Because mine were constantly going when they weren't speaking English.
Oh god.
Well, I mean, like when Jackson's first seeing them and he's trying to learn their language, you don't get a subtitle.
Right. But when he's talking to Ra, it's all subtitled.
Yeah. No, when he's talking to Ra, that is subtitled. Ra is definitely subtitled. Also, it should be mentioned that Ra has a voice of a transformer. anyone catch that?
Oh, yeah.
Wait, his voice? Somebody else's? His dubbed voice?
Yeah.
It just sounds like a transformer.
Yeah. He had a lot of body doubles during filming, too.
Well, so. The Yak also... Frank Welker, who is the voice of Megatron, did some voice work for Ra, and he's also the voice of the Yak.
Oh, nice.
Because, yes, the Yak...
Especially on the Yak part. Good for him.
Yeah.
Thought that I should bring that up a little bit. But anyway, so let's talk about Ra. What did y'all think about the introduction of Ra, when Ra shows up?
Most pointless costume design ever.
Yeah.
Just like fucking weird fingertip bullshit, and just like I found more interesting about like the actor being super difficult to work with, and cause I didn't realize the dude only had two acting credits to his name or whatever.
Oh yeah,
well one of them is the iconic crying game.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which if I remember right, when this came out, my parents were bad-mouthing the movie because, it has that crying game guy in it. Like, what does that matter? So,
have either of you seen Crying Game? Let's start there.
I've already had it spoiled, so I don't need to see it. But I haven't seen it.
Okay, believe it or not, that actually happens about like a third of the way into the film.
Really? Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. I haven't seen it either. It makes you feel better. It's about the third way.
Hmm.
And I will say, if you're not prepared for it, I can understand why people would be super shocked. The way that it's revealed.
Especially in the early 90s.
I wouldn't have been surprised if people had passed out in the theaters.
Wow.
Because you just don't see it coming. You just don't see it coming. You see a character moving down, and you're going down with them, and then, hello, Mr. Happy. Just saying. But Jay Davison as Ra.
Dude looked like a little kid. Super young.
He looks super young, and I understand why, especially with the director's cut, where you see the boy who
you see young
that Ra takes
again.
That scene didn't have to happen, but it does kind of help you to understand kind of what Ra does. But at the same time, though, does Jay Davison just not believe in actually like do stuff? It seems like all that Jay Davison does in this role is to look snarky, like a petulant teenager.
Well, he's playing a god. Gods are petulant teenagers. Come on. That's true. Why aren't you worshiping me right now?
A charismatic villain, and you need to have a charismatic villain to headline your movie about, you know, evil gods who are taking slaves. You know, you have to build a genuine hate for this character and really want to see this character get destroyed. And especially in the way that Rod gets destroyed at the end of the film. It has to earn that. And I mean, yeah, he has his forces, including Jaimin Hanzu.
Yes.
Jaimin Hanzu?
I've got him in the geek sheet later.
Yeah, but he's just Jaimin in this.
Well, yeah, he is. This is before he...
He's like Prince.
Yeah. Well,
no. The thing is that Jaimin Hanzu was like the biggest male model, the French male model in the 90s. And he went by the one name Jaimin. It was when he did Amistad for Steven Spielberg that Spielberg insisted that he use his full name for his film credit to establish himself as a notable actor. And so he did that. Mm. But, okay. Yeah, he was known by his stage name or, you know, his stage persona, which was Jaimin in this film. But part of me is like, the thing is that I know what Jaimin Hanzu is capable of doing. And just seeing him basically just stand tall and not say a word, it was kind of like watching like Robin Williams try to play a tax accountant.
Well, it's the start of his career.
That's true. That is
this
very
is the
true.
Beginning, and then he goes up and up, and we'll list all that later.
That's true. I mean, I love me some Jaimin Hanzu. I love Jaimin Hanzu. So we will definitely have to have that conversation. But yeah, but Ra as a villain is so boring. He's like, I'm going to kill all of you by doing this, and I'm going to do that, and I'm going to twist, and if you fail me, I'm going to touch you on the forehead. Like, that doesn't make for a scary villain. You know, I mean, take how Jaimin kills that one person who fails him, and then kind of put that in comparison to what Darth Vader does to an underling who doesn't work as he's supposed to. There's a menace that a villain has to do. If you're going to kill your own men, you have to show a menace. You have to genuinely bring the fear. Darth Vader can do that. Ra just looks like, oh, you made me mad. I'm just gonna kill you. I mean, it's not like being killed by Darth Vader. It's like being killed by Anakin Skywalker.
Yeah.
Oh, did I say that? I'm sorry. But what about you, Kent? It sounds like you have a differing opinion on this.
Well, he doesn't need to be... The fear of him as the villain isn't that he's any form of badass. It's that all the people around him will do whatever the hell he says. And nobody, not a single one of it. I mean, he's threatened. What happens? Kids jump in front of him.
One thing I really love how they use those headdresses. I love the headdresses.
Oh, yeah.
In this movie. Especially the Anubis and the Eagle ones. I absolutely love, and I love the fact that, you know, they make it out that these headdresses are so menacing and that you can understand why the villagers would be terrified of these creatures coming, while at the same time, though, it's a facade. It's a mask.
Yeah, that's all it is. It's not even full armor on the rest of their bodies that you can see.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, yep, this is the head. Fear me. Like,
yeah. But at the same time, though, I don't know. I mean, they did such a good job of scaring these villagers to the point where the villagers don't even question, hey, that looks like skin on the arms and the legs. It's not as exactly as though we're talking about like statues that are moving or something that looks like a moving statue. It literally just looks like they're wearing a mask. But at the same time, we're supposed to also believe that these people are so docile that they will bend over for any reason whatsoever.
Do they have any reason not to? They have no reason not to. I mean, hey,
well, they have the numbers, as we find out later.
Well, I mean, they have no reason to suspect, oh, this guy isn't a god and he's actually evil. As far as they're concerned, Ra's god, Ra has his servants, we have to hand over the stuff we mine every now and then. Okay, whatever.
And then incur the wrath, because, I mean, just look at how those gliders come in.
Yeah.
And just start blowing shit up.
Most of the time they don't incur the wrath. This time they incurred wrath by taking in the team.
But they don't know if the team was actually with them. They just knew that there was a bunch of Marines, and I'm assuming they're Marines.
Air Force. They're Air Force.
Oh, yeah, that's right. They're
No, they're not Marines. They're United States Air Force Special Forces.
Which is the reason why they got their ass kicked. Okay. All right.
If you're United States Air Force Special Forces, please send your email to...
There's no such thing as Air Force
yes,
Special
there is.
Forces.
Yeah, there is. Every armed force, every branch has their own special forces.
Ground forces?
Yes.
Hmm. Wow.
They don't get as much attention as the SEAL teams and, you know, everybody else,
like,
but they're
absolutely
there.
Absolutely nothing?
They do stuff. Most of the time, it's... the majority of the time, from my understanding, it's forward observation. Infiltrate in.
I mean, recon.
It's marking targets, which is still very hazardous work because you're behind enemy lines, so... It's not as glamorous, but it's there.
Well, I will have to take your word for that, but I've never heard of that kind of force through the Air Force. Usually, they would usually have either Marines or Army mark their targets.
Targets. We could. Yeah, I'm sure we've got somebody that
Could
clarify
to,
more,
enlighten an ignorant soul through. At arthouselegends@gmail.com. I would love to know if there is such a military branch or a special forces unit inside the Air Force that does that kind of thing.
You could probably Google it later, but hey, let's get back to the movie.
So we have a bunch of soldiers who had gotten their asses kicked by a couple of units that were deployed by Ra to take care of them, and then the same units use gliders to go and just attack the village.
Yeah,
Which is, I have to admit, I also love the look and the sound of the gliders.
Oh yeah,
I really like how they're utilized. I like, this is kind of the Star Wars element at this particular point. In a way, I was really hoping, considering that we do have a bunch of Air Force people, there to be a dogfight.
But nobody SEALs one, so...
Yeah, and considering that they are a bunch of Air Force warriors, I would assume that they would know how to attack and to cripple a flighted machine. But hey,
nobody brought along an anti. Of all the weapons they brought along, nobody brought along
a bazooka
and an anti-aircraft missile anywhere, or a big enough caliber gun that they could just sit, like a 50-caliber sniper rifle, just sit there and go, "Okay, I'm going to take a guess here." Bang. Okay,
that is true.
Yeah,
yeah. They definitely, for all the foresight that they had no foresight. Yeah. All right. But so now we have kind of a divide between this, between Jackson and O'Neill, as well as between our heroes and the villagers, right? And so we have kind of two narratives that are kind of playing out. We have Jackson that's trying to find the way home, and he's looking up the hieroglyphs, and he's going to get the backstory. Right? This is the exposition. He's the exposition for this. And then we have O'Neill that has kind of grown close to these young boys who are looking up to him as a hero. Even though, technically speaking, O'Neill never did anything to become a hero.
He's a cool guy. Just look at him. Look at that hair.
He looks
a
like
cool
Guile.
Guy. Yeah! Dude, no, it's Guile from Street Fighter.
When the soldiers come down, I thought to myself, wouldn't they be terrified by the fact that they couldn't see these guys' eyes because of the sunglasses that they were wearing? I mean, if you had black holes where your eyes should be, wouldn't you be, like, terrified about these creatures? Wouldn't you want to, like, you know, stave them off or get them as far away from your village? Would you actually bring them in and feed them?
If you think they're sent by Ra, maybe.
Well, they don't really know that until we get into the village.
And they can see Daniel. Daniel isn't wearing sunglasses.
No, he is wearing sunglasses.
He is? I thought he just had his regular glasses on.
No.
I don't think he was.
Because actually, as a odd goof, they fall off when he gets dragged. And then I guess one of the soldiers picks it up and hands it to him when he stops. But
okay, well, maybe they did fall off after the yak, but...
Yeah.
But then, how is it that his regular glasses didn't fall off?
I thought his regular ones fell off and somebody picked them up. Hmm. Unless his regulars are...
Because I remember him being in the shades.
Yeah. Unless he had flip-up shades on his lenses, but...
Mm-hmm. But anyway, so, you know, these villagers kind of now are... They're on the outs with our heroes. And they decide they have to go back to, you know, because... These forces are coming from the pyramid, right? And then we get Jackson getting killed and O'Neill being taken prisoner, if I'm not correct.
Yeah. Taken prisoner and brought inside. Yeah. Dumped with the others.
And then Ra revives Jackson. Now...
Begins a long streak of... the start of the longest streak about jokes about Daniel Jackson dying. So...
Yeah, I know. Jackson dies like about 100 times in the TV show.
It's that time Jackson died. Which one?
Pretty much. But Jackson... Okay, so the thing is that it's understandable why Rob would bring Jackson back because... Or maybe not, because now that I'm thinking about it, Rob is using Jackson to convince the villagers that Rob is the real deal and that he is not Rob or representative of Rob. Right. Basically, this is a political move. Yet, at the same time, though, Ra has already shown his force by destroying the village. Or, you know, by attacking the village with his gliders. He's already proven himself to be stronger than the forces that have come from the Stargate. So why is he having to reassert force again? Especially by having Jackson kill O'Neill and the other soldiers.
Ego.
Although, I think we all agree that he should have just killed French Stewart, right?
Oh,
I mean, literally, all he does in this God movie is complain.
Stewart. Yeah, but man.
Isn't that all he does in anything, though, really?
You know, you're right.
That's his charm.
You call that charm?
There were air quotes. So.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Yes, podcasting allows you to have air quotes.
Yes.
That's right.
You can see that at home, right? Yeah, it's good.
But, so, didn't this kind of feel a little bit like Return of the Jedi a little bit? Or, you know, kind of the...
Da-da-da-da-da, let me shoot now, let me shoot this guy, and everybody shoots.
Well, I mean, he was forced to kill Jack and to kill the soldiers, yet he sees that... that the village boys had gotten their hands on the guns, and so he turned the gun on Ra. Doesn't shoot Ra, mind you, but basically just causes chaos while the boys were able to hide, to stow away the soldiers and disappear. How do I put this? How the fuck do you disappear in a desert from an alien that has alien technology? I mean, have they hidden away from Ra before? Does that mean that there's been an active resistance that have been working against him the entire time?
I think they just know caves to hide in case a storm blows up.
But wouldn't Ra also know where those caves are?
He may
not.
And
wouldn't Ra be working hard to find these creatures? Because it isn't like he has them on patrols looking for them. In fact, it pretty much goes back to normal operations, because what's the next thing that we see them do? They're infiltrating the pyramid by pretending to be a shipment.
Well, he does have guards.
Right? I mean,
Ra knows he's guarding the gate, so those guys can't get off world. He knows he has loyalists, who will still bring him the stuff. So that's why all the guards are down there to meet the convoy to make sure it's safe when it arrives. He doesn't have to do anything.
Well, the thing is that he knows that the Earthlings have weapons that could fight him.
Right.
I mean, he's seen the guns for himself. They're not exactly defenseless in that sense. And especially considering that they've shown themselves to be capable of fighting, especially after the clusterfuck at the execution, you would assume that Ra would have had more security taken in. Because what he has, like, what, two soldiers, you know, waiting for the convoy? That's underestimating the forces that could be...
I don't think he has a lot of troops at his disposal anyway. And he's pretty thin.
I mean, he has a lot of troops. We see it when we have the big fight at the end.
Because he's got...
I mean, it's not like he has a huge army.
No.
I mean, you're probably talking about maybe, like, what, 10, 20?
Yeah.
Including children? Where do the children come from?
He's breeding them. He has been. Always been, takes them from the village every once in a while.
All right, so if an alien takes over the body of a human being, is he breeding human children, or is it a human-alien hybrid? How does that work?
I think he's breeding the humans separate just to be his servants on the ship. He isn't interacting with any of them directly in that way. He's just regenerating himself in the sarcophagus every few years.
So a guy that distrusts human beings and is extremely paranoid of human beings slitting his throat is allowing human beings to work with him.
To run. So he has his most loyal ones on his ship doing his stuff because they know he's a god and will never question it.
And why wouldn't he just put more aliens in those children's bodies?
He's the last of his kind, according to the movie.
Right. He is the last of his kind.
Yeah. So he has nothing else to... if he found any, he'd do it, because he's lonely otherwise, but...
So does that mean that SG-0 is involved in a genocide?
Yes, and they're quite proud of it. So screw it, this guy enslaved humans, and, you know, he's a bad guy, he's not the best. He also tried to kill members of our team. Kill him. So...
Okay. Who had a problem with the timeline of the final battle? Because...
It is a little bit... Yeah. We have 3 minutes to do this, 5 minutes later. So...
Five? We're talking about ten.
Yeah.
10 minutes later. The only way that the timeline makes sense in the final battle is if we're jumping back and forth in time. But we have no real reason to believe that that's actually happening. We get the sense that all this is happening in real time, right?
Yeah. It's supposed to be, but yeah.
Yeah. Until you get to the 1:40, and then 1 minute, you know, after like 10 minutes of battle, then you go back to 40 seconds is still on the clock. And exactly how was it that Ra was able to destroy the safeguards on the bomb? Does he have like an engineering degree that we don't know about?
Well, he's an alien. He probably does understand. He probably looked at it and was able to figure it out within a few minutes. And just go, oh, so this connects. Oh, it's an atom bomb. Okay, yeah, we did this.
So he opened up the bomb to snip certain wires so that certain safeguards can be turned off.
Yep.
If that's the case, then why even put it back together?
Just to fuck with O'Neill.
We're not talking about, like,
he wants to blow up Earthside. He wants to punish on Earth.
That's true, but the thing is that if he's opening the thing up and snipping wires, then why close it back up again? I mean, having the wires exposed at this particular point isn't going to change anything. All it does is it just confuses them when they flip the toggle switch and nothing happens.
And it screws with whoever he's screwing with, so...
But is he expecting the humans to come and to... get to the bomb?
He's expecting whoever's on the other side to try and shut it off.
That makes sense. To an extent. Yeah. Or as much sense as a movie like this can make at this point. I'll be honest, during this particular screening, turning off the fanboy was very painful for my head.
Yeah.
This movie is really, really, really dumb. Like, super, super dumb. But then again... I think that's kind of Roland Emmerich's MO. But I guess the question then becomes, is this amount of dumb okay in a movie like this, or does it affect how you're watching the movie?
I don't think it affects too much. As long as you're paying attention to what they're saying and going with the flow. Now, apparently on some translations of this, it's hard to understand what's going on. Apparently in like the Mexican translation, it makes it sound like they went back in time instead of to a different planet. So, yeah.
What about you, Chris? Are you having a hard time with the intelligence quotient of this movie?
Yes and no. I mean, I guess, truth be told, I had something come up and I missed the last 15 to 20 minutes of the movie. Yeah.
Really?
And the rest of it, it wasn't really bothering me per se. I mean, I guess I gave it more of a pass because it's, hey, it's 1994. So, yeah, I gave it a pass. But then at the same time, I was like, it's not bad. It's just kind of boring. That's the way I felt about it. So
you're feeling bored this time around? That the movie just wasn't hitting those sweet spots that you were feeling in your teens?
I didn't think, like, I was reading about how I thought it was funny that James Spader originally thought, like, the screenplay was awful, and he only took the fucking role for money. And he's like, there's no problem. There isn't a problem with an actor taking a job for money, for fucking money. Mm-hmm. I thought that was kind of funny, but at the same time, I didn't think anything was that bad for it being as old as it is. I've seen worse, you know, so.
Well, I honestly thought that he took the role just so he could play a good guy for once.
Yeah. Ooh,
ouch,
yeah.
Ouch.
I mean, well, let's be honest here. I mean, up to this particular point, all he's played is assholes. You know, whether it's in a John Hughes movie or if he's playing someone that's manipulating Andy McDowell, you know, he playing a coked out hustler. I mean, that was his MO during the 80s and early 90s. So this is the first and I think the only time that he's ever played a good guy in any movie.
Let's see here.
All I could think of was Ultron.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Well, I'm just thinking about the role that he's most well known for right now, which is Red Redding.
Yeah. But, who is a good bad guy or a bad good guy, either way you look at it. So
yeah, but that does remind me of the time that I was running guns for Fidel Castro.
Yeah.
out of a Chevy Nova that was bought to me, was provided to me by the KGB.
Yeah.
Have you noticed that the stories that Red Redding gives in The Blacklist are even more interesting than the show that you're watching?
Yeah.
I think I watched that show just to hear his stories more than watching the show itself. But seriously though, I mean, Spader. Okay, so let's talk about Spader and his portrayal of Jackson. And I guess, Ken, since you're a fan of SG-1 and of what that actor had done with the role, what is your opinion on Jackson and how Spader brings that character?
I think the continuity works very well between the two. Spader is kind of I call him an excited fish out of water. It's like, yes, I'm right. Oh, wait, I'm not sure how to handle this. Oh, wait,
I'm... Is he genuinely excited? Because he just kind of comes off as... Oh wow, this is happening.
Yeah. It's levels of excitement. It's like he's kind of blown away. It's like, wait, you guys have this artifact that what? I thought it was kind of weird how fast they turn on the Stargate after he figures out how the symbols work. It's like, oh, let's go turn it on right now. What? Right now? We're not gonna think about this more? No. But see,
Jackson didn't say to go ahead and
use. No, he didn't. Right, he didn't say it. The general did. But it kind of makes sense. He's like, wait, what's happening? What's happening? Like, but when he's finally in position, it's like, this is like super academic excitement. You haven't seen very many archaeologists get excited over stuff, have you?
hello, Dr. Jones?
No, I mean in reality.
Well, I can't say that I've hung out with a whole bunch of archaeologists. That's what you're asking.
Yeah, I have, and it in a lot of ways this reminds me of how they are. The only difference is Jackson doesn't drink as much, so...
I don't think he could afford to drink.
Yeah.
In fact, I honestly think that he couldn't even afford the free samples.
Yeah.
Which definitely does come into effect how the film ends, because quite honestly, there's nothing on Earth.
No, it's perfect for him to stay behind. Like, what's he got? Like, he could always go back and try and say, "Hey guys, I have proof." Oh wait, the government's gonna slap so many top secret notices on this, I can't tell anyone. So.
Oh no, they do right before they go down there. I mean, the government basically says, you know, you can't talk about this. Period. They already established that this is to be kept quiet, and rightfully so. This is a national security kind of thing, and that's one of the things I do appreciate about what SG-1 did, was it definitely took that aspect of the Stargate seriously, and I think that's for the better in regards to the lore. That said, though, Jackson, he really doesn't get excited. You know, there's times when he's kind of trying to piece things together, but in a way I feel like Spader is kind of bored.
But he is very respectful when handed a woman, and we mean handed as a gift. It's like, no. So...
I think those are his best scenes because he can play the awkward. He plays awkward best. Yeah. There's one thing that he does here that definitely comes through. But the thing is that when it comes to any other aspects, he just doesn't deliver. You know, when he has to play the hero, when he has to do the one that's rallying the forces, he kind of folds. He puts a lot of emphasis on kind of speechifying, but he doesn't really give a genuine kind of hero's moment. And he has to play a different type of hero than O'Neill. You know, Kurt Russell's Kurt Russell in this movie.
Right.
Right. We can agree that he basically is kick-ass, taking names later. Jackson has to play the brains. You know, he's the one who's going to go up against Raw in person. He's the one who's going to have to confront Raw in person. He's going to be the one that has to figure out the way to defeat Raw. And I do like the fact that both Jackson and O'Neill come to the same idea at the same time. I do like that, especially kind of how it goes, even though I don't know how the hell that pyramid got out of the planet's atmosphere.
That's a fast acceleration.
Equivalently 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Without flattening every surface, trying to gather enough force for escape velocity. Just saying. I get the sense that Neil deGrasse Tyson would be tearing this movie apart.
Funny you should mention him. He shows up in the franchise later. But
that is true. But at least we get one last really good explosion. Is it a good explosion?
It's an explosion. Which, actually, though, for all of O'Neill not shooting those kids earlier, he nuked them.
Yep, all those kids that were... That were
that he would not shoot. Yeah. Raw. Just drop a nuke on them. Why not? And
at least he didn't shoot themselves, right?
Yeah. Oh. And he nuked the cat, too. So...
Yep, the cats. They also killed the cat.
Yeah.
See, they're monsters.
Yeah.
Fuckers.
And then, of course, we have our hero moment. We actually have two hero moments at the end of this movie. I feel like they have a little bit too much celebrating at the end. Can we agree on that? That it's like, yay, we survived. And then Eric Guevara stops everyone and goes, yeah, we did it again. Woo!
Yeah.
Like, you didn't need two celebrations. It wasn't exactly like you were fighting the evil Galactic Empire. You're basically just going after a slave laborer who was dumb enough not to shut off his front door when he decides to go running for the hills.
Yeah.
But I could be wrong on that. So, gentlemen, what do you think about the progression of the characters, especially Jackson's and O'Neill's story and how they kind of unfold? How Jackson decides he's going to stay and kind of lead this society, because, you know, we all know that Egyptians need a pasty white nerd to
save them. Are you saying white savior situation popping up? Even though I don't think he wants to lead them. He just wants to hang around with, you know, his new wife. So,
well, and I mean, let's be honest here. I would definitely forsake a lot of things for Milia Vital. She is a pretty good-looking lady, if I may say so. But let's be honest here as well. He's the one who knows all the engineering.
Yeah,
you know that he's going to be running that shit in about 2 years.
He could start putting two and two together and start going, no, no, guys, this culture on our planet had this way of using the same technology you do to irrigate better. And
let me just put it this way: in 4 years, when they come back for him, he has everyone talking English.
Oh yeah, right, well, just saying, or 20 other languages he speaks. So,
well, no, we hear Eric Avari speaking English in episode one of Stargate.
Yeah, it's because they didn't want to translate.
That's right. That's what I'm saying. He was running that shit because he taught them a whole new language.
Yeah.
They were speaking fluently. Yes. Not even like with an accent. Fluently. And they never dropped it.
You know, it's easier. It's better TV to just everybody speaks English. So
keep making excuses for Jackson. You know he's an overlord. And then he abandons them to go on adventures and die a thousand times.
No, he didn't abandon him. He's chasing his wife, played by a different actress in the series. So,
and we won't spoil what happened to her. All right, so, gentlemen, are we? Do we have any other words before we talk about the Geek Sheet?
Oh, we bring up Geek Sheet. Since there's a weird current cross thing going on right now. Is that since Devlin works on the TV series Leverage now? Apparently he's...
That show has ended. Okay, about, like, 3 years
it did.
Ago.
Okay. The way it seems like people still want to quote it all the time or something. Allegedly one of...
Because it's a great show.
Allegedly one of the characters on there was, according to Word of Writer God, was on either... Which, okay, this is the odd thing. Devlin says the series doesn't really connect with the movie, but then he says that a character on Leverage was part of an SG team.
I think that he was just having some fun with the fans.
Apparently he stated this a few times and worked in. They had a scene ready to be shot that would have taken place, that was a flashback in the gate room, and they couldn't do it because the set had already been struck.
Well, I mean, if they could tie it into Stargate, I would be perfectly fine for that. I'll tell you one thing. Hutton would have been made an awesome SG leader.
I think it's Parker.
Yeah.
He's a team member.
Parker's awesome.
Yeah. So, anyway.
Parker's one of my favorites. But anyway, that's a different show altogether, though.
Okay.
Or maybe.
Yeah.
Anything else we want to talk about with the movie before we go to Geek Sheet?
Let's see. Talked about the reboot. Talked about the trilogy. Yeah, I think I'm ready. I'm ready to Geek Sheet.
All right. Well, Kent, why don't you run us down with the Geek Sheet?
Oh, it's a start at the top with returning champion Kurt Russell, who we talked about for Hateful Hate. Hateful Hate. Oh, God. Hateful Eight. Yes, okay. Yes, known for that. The whole Escape From series. Big Trouble in Little China. Recently, Guardians of the Galaxy 2. And, you know, I just have to mention Sky High because I like that movie.
Well, it's not a bad movie.
Yeah. James Spader, we've already touched on a few things and already said the word Ultron. let's see, touched on Jay Davidson for The Crying Game, who actually never wanted to be an actor, so. And interesting trivia, we have the same birthday, except he's 5 years older, but same birthday. Alexis Cruz is one of the few actors to reprise their role in the TV series, the other one being Eric Avari, who has also appeared on Deep Space Nine, aforementioned Leverage.
We talked about him in Independence Day.
Yeah. Warehouse 13, Enterprise, and I have a note here to revise the West Wing drinking game to include him. It's my West Wing drinking game revision. Whenever an actor who appeared in any form of Stargate shows up, drink. So, you'd be surprised how often that would happen. Rian Lippery, Under the Dome. We're going to avoid the 2013 Lone Ranger, but we're going to mention it anyway. Deadwood, Universal Soldier.
Deadwood.
Yeah. The aforementioned gentleman who I can't pronounce his name. And so, was the villain in Guardians of the Galaxy. So, also a lot of voice acting. Fred Stewart, which touched on Third Rock, appears later on again in Stargate Universe as a different character.
Are we gonna not bring up the fact that Jaima and Hansu is the only actor in this movie that has been nominated for an Academy Award twice?
You can bring that up. So... Wait, Kurt Russell's never been nominated? Bastards.
Yes, he was nominated for In America, which was one of my favorite performances of that year. And he was also nominated for his role in Blood Diamond, which is one of my least favorite movies of that year.
Okay, and I was going to wrap up with returning champion Richard Kind, who we've seen in Argo. Two different characters in the same franchise. He's here, and then he's a different character in Stargate Atlantis. Voice acting, been in Gotham, Inside Out. Yeah, so...
Yep.
That's the rabbit hole I've gone down, so...
In that case, there's one other actor, or not an actor, there's one other person I want to talk about, and that is David Arnold.
Yes.
The guy behind the music of Stargate, and I love this theme. The theme for Stargate, and what I'll call the call to adventure theme that he uses for this, which is, I think, if I'm not correct, that's the theme that has been used for the TV show.
Yes,
was the call to act, the call to adventure. I especially with that opening and just the grandiosity of the score. It's a beautiful score. And David Arnold, believe it or not, has scored, I want to say, 3 different James Bond films. Maybe 4.
Let's see. Casino Royale. Then with Quantum of Solace.
He's also the guy who's been practically behind all of the Sherlock scores.
Yes.
He's also done so much TV, it's not even funny, but
he's done SpongeBob, also, for crying out loud. Come on.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
But yeah, David Arnold is a person whose scores are usually very whimsical, and I love this score. This is my favorite of David Arnold's score. But, Chris, are there any David Arnold scores that have... That have kind of impressed you before?
I'd have to. I haven't looked them up.
No doubt.
He's done quite a bit, so.
Yeah, including I think all three movies of the Cornetto trilogy.
And as composer, he did the GoldenEye video game soundtrack.
Well, that was for the remake of GoldenEye. The original GoldenEye soundtrack was Eric Serra.
There we go. Hot Fuzz.
But,
Little Britain. Casino Royale.
But anyway, so that's going to pretty much be it for the Geek Sheet. So at this point, are we ready to go ahead and call it?
Sorry, getting late.
Yes.
Kent, Chris, do you disagree with the critics on Stargate? Do you give it a fail? Do you give it a pass? Or do you give it a maybe? Kent?
Well, I guess this was my selection, so I in many ways, I better pass this. Well, it kind of depends on what you're looking at. As the introduction to the whole, I miscounted 18 seasons of TV that's going to follow, it is good backing for it. As an independent movie, it's a little bit wanting at times. Like Chris said, sometimes he found himself a little bit bored by it, but it has a lot going on, and I think that slows down the pace. So it's still a pass for me, but it's just that kind of warning that could not be for everyone, but I think the critics were wrong. I think they harshly judged it.
Chris?
It's a maybe for me. I mean, I've already kind of said that it was a little boring at times, but it wasn't really bad. It wasn't really good. It was this kind of cheesy 90s movie, sci-fi movie for me. So, I mean, that's pretty much it. Maybe.
So, I think it should be said that this movie is dumb. Really, 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 really dumb. And I'm looking at the film on a critical scale, especially wondering if the critics were right to bash the film as much as they did. And the fact that the audiences did not come out for this movie in the theaters, and that it took a TV reboot for this to kind of become a thing. And the thing is that as much as I personally still am capable of enjoying it as a fan, by basically allowing myself to revert back to that 13-year-old who was really excited about this movie, the thing is that there's nothing about this movie that is really innovative or that can sustain itself outside of nostalgia. And if I were to not have the nostalgia, if I were to just watch this just completely without any context, even without the TV show, quite honestly, the best I would be able to say about the movie is, well, it makes sense, or, you know, it's coherent in telling a story. Not a good story, but it can tell a story. And that's all I could give it. And that's not really all that a movie should be able to do. I mean, it's better than a lot of movies that can't tell a story altogether. But this movie just doesn't do anything, and it is kind of boring. And the actors kind of feel like they don't want to be there. And it will, again, I mentioned that it takes a TV reboot with people who seem to actually want to be there and actually want to open that world up and explore it. And you just don't get it with this movie. And I am going to completely baffle the 17-year-old me who abhorred the idea of a television show, even though, granted, the first season is pretty bad. I mean, really, really bad. But in later seasons, they definitely caught the spirit and the vibe that they were wanting to go for it. The movie, they actually tried harder than the movie did. And that's a problem. So while I couldn't enjoy it on a nostalgia level, as someone who is looking at this film from a film goer's perspective, I'm going to have to side with that critic part of me and say that this movie doesn't succeed and it doesn't live up to what it needs to do, and that the critics were right. So I'm going to have to fail it. And I'm surprised I'm going to have to fail it. I was really expecting to come into this passing this movie because of that nostalgia, but it doesn't live up. And That's a problem. But if you think that I'm wrong, or if you think that Kent needs to throttle me to enter my life, you can certainly go ahead and let your opinions be known on Twitter at Arthouse Legends or on our Facebook page. Or you can send us a nice little note at arthouselegends@gmail.com, and we will get back to you as soon as possible. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me for this episode. Kent, what do we have coming up?
Next week, we're getting some stuff installed around the old art house cave. But we've got some cable guy coming over to do it. Your choice.
That's right.
The cable guy.
Yes, it is. We're going to be talking about Ben Stiller's 1996 film. Actually, no, it's 1997. His 1997 film, The Cable Guy, starring Jim Carrey and Matthew Broderick. And I'm going to try to convince these gentlemen that this film isn't just good, but that it's a downright classic. And if you want to see me do that, feel free to join us for next week's episode as we get forward with Art House Rejects. But at this point, were there any last words before we give it, we call it a night?
I'm gonna dial that address and get me to another planet. Shalom 1 locked.
Just as long as you're back for next week.
Hey.
Alright. Chris.
Yes. I still smell like a yak. Yeah.
So this is the Movie Dude Eric.
This is Kent.
And this is Chris.
And me. We'll be right back.